and ours is a right intuition when we instinctively refuse to believe that all is finished, that the soul has come to his journey's end. During the whole of a man's earthly life, he is accompanied by the double or unifying body. It is the link between the deeper mind and the brain, and has many important functions. When you fall asleep, your consciousness no longer controls the physical shape. There is not only an apparent cutting off, but an entry into apparent oblivion. The usual disordered dreams are frequently but the play of nerves roused and irritated by the daily activities. Actually, during sleep, the soul exists within the double, while the body is recharged with nervous energy, with life units. So sleep has been wisely recognized as being even more important than food or drink. Space does not permit further discussion of this aspect in the life of man. It is necessary only for you to realize that the double, if it could be made visible, is, in appearance, an exact counterpart of the physical shape. The two are bound together by many little threads, by two silver cords. One of these makes contact with the solar plexus, the other with the brain. They all may lengthen or extend during sleep or during half sleep, for they have considerable elasticity. When a man slowly dies, these threads and the two cords are gradually broken. Death occurs when these two principal communicating lines with brain and solar plexus are severed. It is a well-known fact that life occasionally lingers in certain cells of the body after the soul has fled. This phenomenon has always baffled the physician. But there is a simple explanation for it. The double still adheres to the shell by means of certain of the threads which have not yet been broken. The soul does not suffer in the physical sense if thus delayed in his journey. He may suffer in the sense that he has, thereby, a greater awareness of the immediate surroundings of his physical body. It gives him the power to perceive his friends and relations wherever this worn-out garment lies. As a rule, however, he obtains complete freedom from Earth's detaining grasp within an hour or a few hours of death. When you watch by the dead or grieve for a departed friend, do not be anxious or concerned for him in the incident of death period immediately following his release. For the soul, at that time, is usually in a state of half-sleep. All the agony, all the strange dreams, the tortured fever of mind precede the translation of the soul to the double. At the moment of death, unless that death be of a violent character, peace reigns about the human consciousness. It is resting in dimness and sometimes is capable of perceiving those dear friends or relatives who have already passed to another life. Conditions, of course, vary enormously. The man or woman who has never deeply loved or cared for any other human soul may, at death, rise from the body of clay into loneliness and into a night that, in its impenetrable blackness, is like no night on earth. This state of complete isolation, however, is only allotted to a few human beings. The egoist or the cruel man will be condemned to it. But, for such a fate, his selfishness must be inordinate, his cruelty considerable. The average man or woman, when he or she is dying, suffers no pain. They have become so dissevered already from the body that when the flesh seems to be in agony, the actual soul merely feels very drowsy and has a sensation of drifting hither and thither, to and fro, like a bird resting on the wind. This sensation has its own easeful delight after the pain of the illness which has led the soul to the change of death. So, grieve not for the apparent agony of the dying, rejoice because they are already freed from the torment, are already fluttering between two existences and abide in that nameless content which is due to the quiescence of mind and awareness. Slowly the soul then rises into the double and for a brief time hovers above the physical counterpart. Someday men will be able to photograph this moment, and the being that passes thus may be registered on the plate as a little white cloud, a pale essence. Only so can this kernel of personality appear to even the finest material instrument. But, to discarnate beings, very different will seem the flight of the soul, for the perceptions of the etheric body are far more finely attuned. And usually those relatives or friends who attend upon death journey to it from the etheric world. The place of five Hados, Hades. It is not possible to deal with even a tithe of the conditions which prevail in Hades for the multitude of the newly dead. I will, therefore, Merely trace the course of an average man who has led a well-ordered life on Earth. According to the nature of the individual, so, also, is the length of his stay in the place of shadows. After a vision of the blood kindred or psychic kindred, and sometimes after communion with them, the soul rests seemingly within a veil, in a state of peaceful quiescence, of semi-suspended consciousness, seeing fragmentary happenings of his past life, these being now neither tainted by fear nor whipped by emotion. He watches this changing show as a man drowsily watches a shimmering sunny landscape on a midsummer day. He is detached and apart, judging the individual who participates in these experiences, judging his own self with the aid of the light from above. The terms within the husk or the play of the shadow show define this period. Souls vary considerably in their reactions to it. Some retain scarcely any recollection of it. Others are too aloof and too drugged by the condition of peaceful quiescence to feel either pleasure or pain. But all the while progress is being made, the etheric body is loosening, working out, withdrawing from the husk, until, at last, judgment is completed. The soul takes flight, casts the husk from him as a man throws an old cloak from off his shoulders. For the spirit or light from above has accomplished its work of summing up, leaving to the traveler the final decision. Once our pilgrim has, as it were, cast his skin, flung away the tattered remnant that bound him to mortality, he passes into the world of illusion and resumes full consciousness. The double, re-imaged within the veil, becomes the body of the man in the next life, only the outer rind or after image has been flung away. 3 or 4 days of earth time may suffice for this experience of the shadow show, for the reknitting and readjustment of the ego to the etheric body. It is true, however, that certain abnormal men and women linger a long while in Hades and wander to and fro in its grim ways, encountering certain strange beings who hover near the borders of the physical world, who wake old sorrows and troubles in the minds of men, and who play upon the understandings of certain individuals they would possess while still in the flesh, dethroning the reason, stealing from man his birthright. But these creatures have no part in the chronicle of death. For they cannot harm or hinder the pilgrims who journey from the world to us, drifting without pain or stress through Hades, that place of half-lights, of drowsy image-making, and, with a few exceptions, in no way or sense a place of fear or suffering. Memory and identity after death. Physiologists will tell you that memory is merely a condition of the brain. Injure a certain part of that delicate organism and the healthy individual will become mentally a blank, will be quite unable to recall any fact concerning himself, any past experience whatsoever. Actually, this unfortunate man has not forgotten his past nor is he intellectually a blank. A certain part of the mechanism of the brain has ceased to function. So he is unable to manifest any intelligence, dependent on memory, to the visible world of men. But he is still intellectually alive, and retains complete power over his memory apart from his actual physical body. For the double or unifying shape is the counterpart of that physical body, and registers, more or less as the brain registers, facts and experiences in the life of its owner. Bear in mind that the double accompanies the man from birth till death. Houses and shelters his soul, serves him even more faithfully than the actual physical shape of which he is daily aware. According to the human view, memory is necessary to a sense of identity, to the idea of individuality and all that is conveyed by the word soul or consciousness. Sense of identity, however, is not lost through the change of death, for the soul finds his fundamental memory center in his double which, as I have informed you, is his habitation in the afterlife. As the double casts away an outer husk, only its essential part, the etheric body, which has accompanied the traveler and functioned for him all through his earth life, goes on and serves the soul on the plane of illusion, maintaining continuity of individuality through continuity of memory. During the play of the shadow show, this etheric shape gathers new force, is remolded, readjusted to the soul. And there is a strange and wonderful renewal, a sense of flooding life in the last stages as the butterfly breaks through the chrysalis, as the individual who has entered the period within the husk, an old decrepit man in appearance, passes from it in a youthful body, pulsating with life and eager with human desires. On the plane of illusion these desires are satisfied. If I recollect rightly, certain Easterns believe that the human being, in his construction, resembles an onion and possesses at least six bodies which all exist at the same time. I have found no evidence of these numerous shapes. They may, of course, exist. I can only write out of my own knowledge. F. W. H. M. We shall not all sleep apart from revelations. What is the teaching of the Bible concerning the afterlife? We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. The words of St. Paul harmonize with the account of the afterlife given in these pages. The phrase "we shall not all sleep" implies that many do sleep until the last trumpet sounds, until the end of the earth. In what garden, in what world, in what space do these sleepers rest? As birds live in air, so do these souls exist in the etheric zone which is about the earth. They are inhabitants of the world of illusion. Now, on that plane, save in the last stages, there is an almost entire absence of conflict and effort, accordingly there is an absence of any true creation. Many human beings regard such a state as the most desirable condition of being. When they ask for heaven while on earth, they indicate, by the word heaven, a life without conflict or effort. Those of them who are satisfied with such a life meet it after death in the illusion world, and so linger within its borders until the last trumpet sounds. This phrase of St. Paul's must be read symbolically. It possessed its own peculiar meaning in the ancient world, a meaning which has been lost. The souls who rest on the third plane until they are roused by this summons may be fitly called the sleepers. For what does sleep indicate if not an absence of conscious conflict and effort? Existence seems in many respects as real to the occupant of the world of illusion as it does to king, politician, lawyer, doctor, clergyman and working man on earth. But it contains one important difference. The soul has no need to put forth struggle or effort. He obtains his desire through the mere act of desire. So he cannot be said to live as he did on earth, or gloriously as he will live in the world of Eidos. He is, in truth, the sleeper mentioned in the New Testament. 65. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. This text infers that some of the dead do not sleep. In other words, many of those who have died scorn the pleasant fields of illusion, their deep content. They desire conflict, creation, effort, and so they either become incarnate again or they wisely choose to go upwards and to enter the world of Eidos, to find, indeed, life more abundantly within that masterpiece. For in that state of grace the traveller meets with the finest glories of appearance, with the triumph of life in form. The afterimage, or husk, the afterimage might be likened to an old traveller's cloak. Though he discards it, it remains by the roadside and may be picked up and worn again. Ghosts have been known to walk for many years in certain old mansions at certain seasons, or inconsequently, without apparent rhyme or reason. Say to yourself if you meet one of these restless shades, here walks the ancient cloak, the old disguise, perhaps, of some roundhead or cavalier, of some cowled monk or holy nun, of some modern gentleman who has indulged in butchery or has himself been murdered with new weapons but with the same old passions of rage and hate behind him. It is that same repetitive passion that provides the energy which, for a brief space, reanimates the afterimage. But it may not walk in its own place if there be not association of memory, an energizing thought or idea behind it. Somewhere within the far realms of space exists the brawler who died so violently, or the nun or monk who enriched that cloak with all their brooding religious passion. They are resting, withdrawing temporarily from their active life in another sphere, and, for a moment, by reason of the binding threads of past fate, envisage again the old scene where they lived or from which they took their leave of life. They cast on it but the careless thought which is now unclouded by remorse, regret or any emotion. But the mere light flick of their thoughts tears up the old cloak, causing it to masquerade again within the building or about the grounds which were familiar to it in life. But be assured that the essential ego does not return and play the old part, making mockery of it on the stage of earth, with its insubstantial vaporing, with its elusive vanishing into air. No, Such ghosts or phantoms, who wander thus meaninglessly, are indeed but ancient garments dust back to visibility at the appointed hour when the man or woman who has inner sight is present to record this deceptive masquerade. All rules have their exceptions, and so all hauntings may not come under any one rule. But it is accurate to accept the average ghost as a persistence of a manifestation of energy through the medium of the afterimage, focused by the pull of an old thread of passionate memory. Violent death. Sometimes the dead do not know that they are dead. This statement may seem incredible. Yet it is true in certain fairly rare cases. Only the past history of the dead man can make clear this curious lack of apprehension of his state. If he passes through the gates of death bearing with him a passionate love of material possessions, he will, even after a fleeting glimpse of his discarnate kindred, tenaciously hold to the belief that he is still a man of flesh and blood, wandering, perhaps, on the hills in a mist, but still filled with the life of earth. He will passionately seek for his house, his money, or whatever is his particular treasure, in the dark ways beyond death. And sometimes they may appear in an elusive manner a little ahead of him, leaping thus only for a brief moment before his subjective vision and then vanishing. The cloud descending once more, reducing all things for him to nullity again. Such an egoist will linger for some time on the borders between the two worlds, freedom coming when the force of that passion for material possessions weakens and fades. There are also certain others who linger thus in Hades, but not unhappily as a rule. I refer to certain young men of careless, animal and, occasionally, vicious life who die violent deaths. These poor fellows are suddenly wrenched from their bodies while still they are in the prime of manhood. They are not, in any sense, capable of grasping, for a while, the difference between earth life and the afterlife. So they too remain in ignorance, and must remain in a kind of coma until the delicate etheric body has recovered from the shock of a too rapid severance from the earthly shape. However, the great majority of men and women after death flit like passenger birds through Hades, resting only for a brief while here or there, making one contact with their old friends or relatives who preceded them, held but for a short spell by the play of the shadow show and then loosed into the new life. Into the effortless land where the pattern is again woven, but on that plane it will have no new design, no new threads or colors. The death that follows a period of senility, the very old may, before their passing from earth, in part lose memory or lose their grasp of facts, their power of understanding. This tragic decay all too often causes the observer of it to lose his faith in an afterlife. For the soul seems, under such circumstances, merely the brain. This, however, is a false conclusion. The soul, or active ego, has been compelled partially to retire into the double during waking hours because the cord between the brain and its etheric counterpart has either been frayed, or has snapped. The actual life of the physical body is still. The incident of death maintained through the second cord and through any of those threads which still adhere to the two shapes. So the aged, apparently mindless man or woman, is in no sense mindless. He or she is merely withdrawn a little way from you and has no need of your pity, for, through that withdrawal, his awareness is almost wholly confined within his unifying body, the body of his resurrection. The pattern beyond ambition, beyond any human forms of selfishness, beyond the struggling, scarcely least desires, are affection, love, the drawing, intangible force between kindred souls. It is stronger than death, it conquers despair and may conquer on all the finite levels of existence. It must be reckoned as a cosmic principle and is known as the power behind the pattern which is being woven for you as long as time, for you, exists. Death seems terrible to the average man because of its apparent loneliness. If he but knew it, his fears are vain, his dread of being reft from the pattern, that is to say, from those he loves, has no foundation. Has no real substance behind it. For, wherever he may journey after death, always will he be caught again into the design of which he is a part, always will he find again, however deep his temporary oblivion or however varied his experience, certain human souls who were knit into his earth life, who were loved deeply, if sometimes blindly or evilly, by him in those bygone days. It is true that the more primitive types are incapable of the love of the whole being. They fail to understand that to love in this manner is to observe the first laws, for it is a love that has within it the seeds of immortality. Such primitive souls as are at the beginning of the pattern frequently initiate its design with hatreds, deathless antagonisms, which, encountered again on the third plane, hound back such souls to earth, where they are reborn, and where, if progress is made, they may learn the first spiritual law, namely, the law of the beloved. No man or woman who has mastered it need fear death, for, even if he go first, some other who is in his pattern and therefore truly his kindred will speedily join him, give him greeting in the great adventure which lies beyond death. Call death your friend. Hail death as your deliverer. For the darkness and soil which is in every earth love passes, vanishes with your passing. Chapter 13, The Evolution of the Psyche. In the previous pages will be found a rough chart of existence. It was inadvisable to enter, in such a chart, upon any detailed description of the qualities essential to the navigator if he would speedily and successfully steer his course across these strange worlds. When I was on earth I was a firm believer in the power and strength of agape or love. In the New Testament Saint Paul uses the word which is translated as charity, but attributed to it a meaning which has been also allotted to love. Here, in the afterlife, I perceive that neither of these words conveys the whole significance of the good, for they have been so long interpreted by human and finite minds that they have become worn and defaced, soiled and obscured by contact with many natures of an infinitely varied character. To some, the word love means only the passion which lights up between man and woman, to others, it is the intellectual love shared by two friends, kindred souls. Thirdly, and lastly, love is held by many to be compassion for others and to contain within it that communal sense of the brotherhood of man, that love, in general sense, which has led, undoubtedly, to fine endeavor in past times. But always these conceptions fall short of the ideal. Though again and again agnostic and Christian study the Gospels, image in their hearts the Sermon on the Mount, still they fail, still their understanding perishes in the presence of the great words of immortality. No man or woman has ever really succeeded in understanding or grasping the whole lofty vision of love as it was seen by the Christ. So now, as I survey the present earth and perceive the chronicle of the years, I am sensible of the need of a word which has not been debased by men, which can still suggest and contain the primary need of the soul, which will define that urge so essential to the psyche when it would climb from one rung to another on the ladder of consciousness. The permanent reality of progress is to be found in increase of wisdom. For wisdom may be defined as right judgment concerning truth. Upon every plane of being the conception of truth must necessarily be limited or enlarged by the conditions of life, by the form the soul assumes, or by that extension of consciousness which, at the last, tends to shake off form, as the trees in autumn cast off their leaves. On the dense plane of matter known as earth the term truth is still holient, to the minds of many men, unsoiled. It may, therefore, be used to illustrate what I believe to have been Christ's meaning where the word love is put into his mouth in the Gospels. But it is not complete unless right judgment is added to it. Consider, then, the significance of wisdom. For, clearly, within that lofty word resides the highest love between man and woman, intellectual love, compassion, faith and last, but not least, the power of vision. All these are possessed by the man or woman who rightly judges truth. And, on whatever plane your soul or the soul of the beloved is evolving, be assured that wisdom is the primary urge which causes this soul to choose to go up rather than down, to select the finer life, the greater reality, rather than existence in denser form, in more material worlds. Love your enemies. Bless them that persecute you. These beautiful and enigmatic phrases have troubled and perplexed every sincere Christian who has endeavored to apply them to his own life. Only through wisdom can he, in any measure, fulfill their command, expressing them literally in act and thought. For they are contained in wisdom. Their idea depends for its manifestation, for its very life, on right judgment of the truth. The simple peasant, the humble working man or woman, ignorant in the eyes of the world, may yet be wholly wise if they possess this spiritual discernment, which, for the human soul, expresses Christ's vision when he spoke of love. So must it be on each plane of being in the unseen. Wisdom is the light that, in every instance, gives shape and life to love, is its secret hidden root, is the inspiration, the power that causes the forward and upward progression expressed in the term the evolution of the psyche. Part 2, Instruction about various human faculties and other matters. Chapter 14, Free Will. The term free will presents different meanings to different people. For some it implies the idea that in all we do we are following out our own particular fancy or desire so far as is possible. For others, free will seems to imply simply the right to choose, the right, when we come to crossroads, to follow the particular lane that seems, from our point of view, the most alluring. Perhaps we decided to travel along the beech-shaded road and not the road that is open on every side. Who makes that decision? I should call it the aggregation defined by the term, body, soul, and spirit. Now, all these are built up out of various elements, but all are one creation. They have been slowly shaped through the ages. All the hereditary influences must be included. All the influences of a psychic and a spiritual character are there. These seem innumerable to our finite minds. Circumstances, friends, enemies, relations, all help to mold that inner being which makes the decision to follow that beech-shaded road. Does it not strike you, therefore, that you are asking what is impossible because of the very nature of our being when you make the demand that free will must rule? We are obviously merely the creation of many other men and women living and dead. Therefore we are largely the victims of their varying influences and are bound to follow those tendencies implanted in us. In other words, all mankind is, in a sense, one, and yet many. Man's history, his character since the dawn of the world, might be conceived as a vast web ever growing and growing, and the source of it all is to be found in the master spinner who is responsible for every particle of that fine fabric, for the whole history, the whole character of man since the beginning of time. Now, you must realize that as God is the creator, the great master builder, He knows what shape the life of the individual will take before that individual is born. He knows exactly the nature of the unborn babe, how he will develop from the hour he leaves his mother's womb, where his tendencies will lead him, the manner in which circumstances will mold him. For the great picture of all creation has been conceived in the imagination of God before ever the babe has evolved out of what we call the void. For instance, the future of the earth is imaged already in the imagination of God. It has happened because He has already thought it. But what has not happened is the change in the individual soul, the manner, for instance, in which it reacts to the trials and the joys of life. The reactions of the soul are all that matter in connection with your earth life. Will sorrow embitter you? Will ruin unnerve you to fresh effort? In the latter instance, you create within yourself in that you increase the power of your will, increase your courage. Or will you give up hope and sink into penury, thus increasing the weakness of your character? You have, in short, free will only in the sense of creation, only in the molding of your own soul. Now that is the important and vital factor in connection with your life on earth. For when you go back to the group soul of which you are one, according to the mold of your soul so shall be the mold of circumstance in the future life of the young soul of your group who is about to be born. It is hard to put my idea into words. God watches over the cosmic life of the group souls. And, according to their growth, He plans or designs the future of the life of mankind. But because it was all imaged by Him at the beginning so is there little to change in the vast cosmic picture that lies in His imagination. Chapter 15, Memory within and without the body. I shall try to give you a brief account of some of the aspects of memory as they present themselves to me. First of all, you would probably like to understand memory, as it is in the case of the living. What do? Your will decides that you shall remember the name of Tom Jones. It makes the effort to concentrate upon that image. What is the exact process? It draws to it a certain very fine essence invisible to the human eye. Scientists might describe that essence as something far subtler than electricity and yet of the same nature. This, if the will be strong enough, can be led to make the necessary imprint again upon what would appear to you, if you had the perception, to be something fluid, something that flows.